It's blazing hot outside. You get in your car to turn on the AC to get cold air pumping, but it blows hot air out. This issue is commonly caused by low refrigerant due to leaks in the AC system. You want an easy, all-in-one solution that will restore the cold air in no time. AC Pro Recharge Kits make restoring cold air easy for even those with zero DIY experience in less than 10 minutes. Save time and money versus going to a shop by picking up an AC Pro Recharge Kit today. Be a pro with AC Pro.
Welcome back to the MLB.com Ballpark Dimensions Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Petriello, writer and analyst for MLB.com, joined by Matt Myers, MLB.com National Content Editor. No guest this week, so we're just going to get right into a couple of interesting things to talk about. We're going to wonder what the standings look like in this weirdo year and how they're maybe not as far off from expectations as we thought. Dig into the quieter thing that Fernando Tatis Jr. is doing well. Wonder what a world in which Jacob deGrom wins a third consecutive Cy Young might look like by reader request, listener request. Dig into the Oakland A's. And as usual, we will get into focusing on some interesting players you might not know enough about and some fun rants at the end of the show. I do want to start with the standings, though. I don't think I need to tell anybody who's listening that this is a very weird and unusual and crazy and silly baseball year. And part of that goes into having 60 games instead of 162 games. What might happen? You know, could you end up with the Tigers and the Orioles and the ALCS? I guess it's still possible. But what I was struck by is when I looked at the standings the other day, and you look at the top of the leaderboards, and you know, we're still only like 35, 40 games into the season. Right now, the division leaders are in the American League, the Rays, Cleveland and Chicago tied at top of the Central, Oakland, and then the National League, Atlanta, Chicago, and the Dodgers. And that sounds right to me. Like, that doesn't sound... You could have made that projection at the beginning of a regular six-month season, and you wouldn't have been far off. And if you look at some of the teams on the bottom, too, the Royals are not good. The Pirates are not good. I know the Yankees are having a weird year. The Orioles are playing better than expected. But what do you think, Matt? I was sort of surprised, I guess, a little bit at how quickly things sort of looked like I thought they would.
Well, I guess, you know, I can toot my own horn and say I'm not surprised at all because in the American League, those are exactly, I think, my picks for who was going to win the divisions. I definitely had the Rays, A's, and White Sox to win. And I know that I was perhaps mocked by you on this very podcast for maybe being a little early on the White Sox. So far that one is actually looking pretty decent. And I know that I had the Cubs in the NL and I'm pretty sure I had the Braves and Dodgers as well. So I might be 6 for 6. I'm trying to actually pull this up now as we speak. I might be 6 for 6, but if not, I'm close. So I cannot say that I'm surprised about that. Yes. As I'm looking at it right now, those are exactly my six division picks. So I can't say I'm surprised by that. No. What's more surprising, I guess, is what's kind of going on at the fringes of the races, right? Where we're seeing, you know, right now the Yankees holding on for dear life as an 8 seed in this expanded playoff. And in the NL, you've got the Marlins and Giants in the playoffs today, if the playoffs start today. That's the kind of stuff that I think is really what is what's surprising people, right?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, when I compare the opening day Fangraph standings to what we have now, right? And you just mentioned the Giants. They are one of only four teams who are projected to be under 500 and now over 500. And if you look at those four teams, the Phillies were projected to be under 500 by 497. So it's like basically at 500, right? And they're a little better than that. The Jays, the Marlins, and the Giants. I don't think the Jays taking a step forward is a huge surprise. The Marlins, obviously, we know their season's been bizarre, although I'm proud of myself for not picking them last. I picked them in fourth because I sort of like them. And then the Giants. And you brought this up privately yesterday and having a chance to look into it. The Giants can hit now, like at home. Brandon Belt, who has, you know, always been killed by his home park, is now like 300 points of OPS better at home. Is that small sample weirdness? I don't know, but I would like to find out. Then you've got 12 teams that were projected to be over 500 and are great. 8 teams that were projected to be under 500 and are great. And then 6 teams that were expected to be over 500 but aren't. And I think those are the interesting ones, right? I was very down on the Brewers. I hated their offseason. I was very down on the Angels because they couldn't pitch. You know, the Mets are the Mets. They could be in first or last, and that would surprise nobody. We knew the Red Sox weren't going to pitch in the least. I was actually surprised they were projected as high as they were. The two teams, I guess, that have surprised me in terms of underperforming are the Reds and the Nationals. The Nationals have the oldest or close to it team in baseball. And I think we talked about this over the winter. That seemed great for like a couple month postseason run, but it didn't seem like it was going to work to just kind of bring the same guys back. Right. I mean, what's the most surprising team to you other than the Giants, I guess, at this point?
I want to say the Yankees, just because, like, you know, they started out so hot, but it's hard to separate the Yankees from their and right now they're what, 500. The thing is, with the Yankees, it's hard to separate them from their injuries. And, you know, it's sort of like that's kind of happened year in and year out. I mean, you build a team that's relying on Aaron Judge and Giancarlo Stanton, and well, they're sort of seeing the problem with that because they can never get the two of them on the field together. They were on the field together for like the first 2 weeks of the season. The Yankees started 16-6. They both got hurt, and they're what, 5-15 since, and hit 500. So it doesn't kind of take a genius to figure out kind of why the Yankees are struggling. You know, in the past couple of years, they've managed to get some of these amazing performances out of nowhere. You know, your Mike Tauchman, who seems to have come back to earth, you know, was kind of like almost like a was like an above average player the last year and a half. This year he's been pretty terrible. There's always the expectation that maybe Gary Sanchez is going to figure it out, and now I think we may just have to believe that Gary Sanchez like is not going to figure it out, and maybe just is not a very good hitter. So the Yankees is sort of hard to separate from the injuries, I guess. You're right. That's the thing. None of these, all the teams that are sort of like underperforming, all kind of had red flags. You mentioned the Reds, right? They added a lot of players, but it was still kind of like a square peg situation where like the pieces didn't necessarily fit that cleanly, and you could definitely see some potential downside there. It's more the overperformers that are kind of surprising. But again, we're talking about a 45 game sample, right? The idea of like the Marlins going 19-18 over a 37 game sample. People are like, oh, well, the Marlins are playing so well. I mean, they're surprising, but they're like, they're one game over 500 with a run differential of zero. So they're like, I guess they're overperforming, and there are reasons to believe that they might be a better. The thing about them now is they've actually improved their team. They've added Sixto Sanchez from the minors, who looks like a beast, and they traded for Starling Marte. So like actually the Marlins are now legitimately a better team than they were on opening day. You could sort of say, okay, well, like now they are really well positioned to make the playoffs and be kind of interesting when they get to the playoffs. Whereas like some of the other teams that are kind of surprising still feel like kind of like full gold, like the Orioles do a little bit. Then again, it's hard to believe that the Orioles and Yankees have a four-game series this weekend that's like basically going to decide the final playoff spot.
Must-watch baseball.
It's not something I imagined saying when the season began.
If the season ended today, and I guess that's always a possibility at this point, the Rays and the Yankees would have a first-round playoff matchup. And as we say today, it's Wednesday afternoon as we're recording this, so maybe that changes by the time you hear this. How fun would a Rays and Yankees three-game set be after all of the, you know, back and forth garbage between those two teams so far this year? I would watch that, is what I'm saying.
Yes. I mean, like from a, you know, you actually kind of want to see the Yankees get some of their guys back on the field just to make it feel like it was like the real representative teams facing each other. I would obviously, it's, you know, you'd like to see the Rays kind of make a little bit of a run, at least it'd be nice to see them make a little run, because it seems like finally the success on the field is matching, you know, sort of the expectations going into the, for the first, they're not sneaking up on anyone, like, and they're in first place. They've got the best record in the American League. So but Rays Orioles would also be amusing. But yes, Rays Yankees, given the history between those two teams and the animosity, would definitely be one to watch. So yeah, just to go through, I think it's fun to go through it all. If the playoffs start today, it would be Rays Yankees, A's Twins. Noted that the A's have what I think the A's have won. Is it the A's? Is there one playoff series win in like the Billy Bean era, was when they beat the Twins in the division series in 06? Was that, am I getting that right?
That sounds vaguely familiar, but I honestly don't remember.
It'd be Indians Astros and White Sox Blue Jays. It'd be awesome to see the White Sox and Blue Jays in the first round because of all the young talent, but it'd be almost like sad that one of them would have to go. And then actually you'd have Giants Dodgers, which is just would be amazing. Like this Giants team knocked out the Dodgers. Cubs Marlins, Bartman revenge series, right there. You have Braves Cardinals, rematch of last year's DS, and Padres Phillies. So that's kind of the fun of these expanded playoffs is you're getting all these matchups, some of which have like these rich histories, and others that are like, wait, what? These teams have no history. There's nothing there. But that's sort of kind of the randomness is kind of what makes it exciting.
You know what I just realized about the A's, and we'll get to them more in just a minute. I'm not entirely sure how I feel about this first round of three-game playoff series, but it does prevent the A's from losing the one-game wild card, which they have done in each of the last 2 years and also in 2014. So I think they will be thrilled just to have multiple games. All right, let's go to our three-batter minimum segment where we kind of dig into three interesting topics. And my first one here is, I don't know if you guys noticed, Fernando Tatis Jr. is having a really good year. He is crushing the ball. He is, if not the front runner for the National League MVP, I guess he's definitely at least in the conversation, right? He is he's hitting, he's fielding, he's running, he's flashy, he is the next big baseball superstar. And I guess the word you use to describe him is, I don't know, loud, exciting. Like there's nothing quiet about him. You know, he crushes it and he's a lot of fun to watch. But I do think that there is something quiet about him that's important to notice, and that's his defense has improved in a way you might not have expected. I think you could have surprised a lot of people last year. You watch him making all these ridiculous highlight plays to say, well, actually, he was not a very good shortstop last year. Remember, he only played 83 games at short because he got hurt a couple of times. And if you were to look at the Statcast metric, outs above average, he had a minus 13 mark, which was tied for the fifth worst. Remember, he played half the season. 26 shortstops played more innings than he did. And no one in baseball at any position had more throwing errors than he did, 14. He actually made enough throwing errors to get into a tie for the 19th most in a season of the 30-team era dating back to 1998. And if you watched it, it wasn't that he had problems getting to the ball, obviously. It was mostly that he would get to the ball and make a throw really he should have just eaten, like he had no business making, or just make a wild throw that Eric Hosmer couldn't get. I split it into difficulty. And you can look at the difficulty of each individual play, rank it from a 0%, like a no shot, to a 100%. Everybody makes this play. And I sort of arbitrarily split it into three different categories of easy, medium, and hard. And on the hard plays, the ones that are considered to be a 0 to 40% chance of being made, he's actually slightly above average. He was plus one. He's good at the hard plays. This is last year. Lousy on the medium plays. So between 40 and 80% chance of being made, he was minus five. And terrible on the easy plays. Between 80% and 100% chance of being made, he was minus nine. I think that tells a lot of the story. Obviously, he was a rookie. He's a young guy. He was trying to make every play because he's got a cannon of an arm. And he was just making a lot of mistakes. And overall, that made him kind of not a valuable shortstop to the point where I wondered if he was going to be an outfielder at some point. Well, flash forward to this year. So far, he has played 355 in the third innings. That is the most of any shortstop in baseball. He has one error, and it wasn't throwing, it was fielding. We're going to release our infield outs above average for the season in a couple days, and he's plus one. That doesn't sound flashy, but remember last year he was minus 13. So he's gone from near unplayable to average or slightly above. If you look at the Padres infield as a group, last year they were terrible. Next to last, minus 25 outs above average. This year, plus three. That is fifth, obviously, in just a couple weeks of play. And I think that is worth stopping to focus on for all the big, loud, fun, exciting things that Tatis does. Improving the easy plays, not messing up the simple ones, is as valuable as any of the rest of that, I think. And that's a big reason that the Padres are having kind of, you know, maybe a year ahead of schedule breakout season.
Without question, it's kind of cool. And I think it's, as you said, it's kind of unnoticeable just because like he was already making the flashy plays last year. So people kind of assumed he was a great defender, but now that the metrics are lining up with the eye test, and we're seeing it. We know kind of more objectively that he is as good as people thought he was. And also, it's, you know, I'm very interested to, and we'll probably go over this maybe in our next show of like what the infield outs above average leaderboard tells us, because this is like an interesting story that we're getting right here with like Tatis and his improvement. Two things about Tatis I want to mention. You said amazing things. Did you see the play of him getting? It was on Tuesday night, I guess. He was pitched inside. He did like a limbo.
Yes.
Basically, like folks, listeners, if you didn't see it, Sarah Lang tweeted it, and you should go to her Twitter feed. It may be the most impressive athletic move he's ever done. And that's saying a lot from Fernando Tatis Jr. The second thing I'll mention is that you mentioned him as MVP favorite. I think that it's like, I want to say he's like a virtual lock at this point.
I'm going to have to actually pull up the leaderboard because I was just sort of speaking off head.
I'm looking at Fangraphs, right? I'm looking at the WAR leaderboard, and to be clear, listeners, I'm not saying that the WAR, especially in 50 game sample, is like the definitive word on who the best player is. Just to be clear, it is a starting point. I treat it as a starting point, not an ending point. To be clear, but as a starting point, he is far and away number one in baseball. He's at 3.1 WAR. No one else is above 2.3. You've got Mookie Betts and Mike Yastrzemski at 2.3 amongst position players. I should be clear. So I think when you factor in the fact that he's leading in Fangraphs WAR, the narrative is totally behind him. The Padres are sort of like the exciting like upstarts of the season. He's doing everything well, everything exciting. It sort of feels like it's almost like it's a fait accompli that he is going to win National League MVP. American League will be much trickier. I just realized something I didn't even know, that Mike Trout doesn't even lead the Angels in WAR on Fangraphs. Anthony Rendon has quietly surpassed him, but I guess because the Angels as a team have been so underwhelming that Rendon's amazing season's kind of getting forgotten. But I think that, as of now, we're going to be running an MVP poll on MLB.com on Friday, and I have to imagine that Tatis is going to be running away with the National League now.
I think you're probably right. I think, Yastrzemski's not going to win it. Betts has had a great season, but I think people think there's so many great players in the Dodgers, it's kind of hard to point to any one guy being that valuable. So I think you're probably right. And then also, I was just realizing that it seems very likely that Jake Cronenworth is going to win the National League Rookie of the Year for the Padres as well. And so then I wonder, who from the Padres can we get to win the National League Cy Young? Maybe this is Luis Perdomo's moment to shine.
A man can dream. But no, if we're going to talk about the NL Cy Young, this is a very good segue to our next
topic. I'm a professional podcast host. I almost did that on purpose. Do you think Jake DeGrom has a real shot of winning a third straight Cy Young award? He just kind of keeps on going. I remember an opening day where there were a couple guys who, their velocity was down. Obviously, we had the whole wonky summer camp 2.0 and all that, and his velocity was up. And so far this year, he has been, as usual, fantastic. He has a 169 ERA. He is striking out 13 per 9. His 38% strikeout rate leads National League starting pitchers. Again, he has won the last two National League Cy Young Awards. And obviously, a lot can happen over the next couple weeks. But if you were to look at the other contenders in the National League, I think the main competition, I would have said two guys before the other day. I would have said Yu Darvish, who has been absolutely fantastic. And I would have said Max Fried, who's been great for Atlanta as like literally the only Atlanta starting pitcher. But how Fried is hurt doesn't sound like it's going to be serious, but I think in a short season, missing any amount of time is enough to set you back. And I would have maybe said like Josh Hader, had he really gone through a whole year with zero hits allowed, because like this is the year to do that, right? But that didn't happen. And there's an argument that Devin Williams is a better Milwaukee reliever anyway. And you can go down the list and you could say, okay, yeah, maybe Trevor Bauer has been really good. Sure. Clayton Kershaw has a 150 ERA, but in 15 fewer innings. Denelson Lamed and Scherzer and Wheeler and Zach Allen's been really good. But it sort of comes down to me right now to, I think, Darvish and DeGrom, and they're more or less tied, I think, pretty close. You can go either way. So I guess we can agree that it's at least very reasonable that he might win a third straight Cy Young. And if he does, I think you have to count it as quote unquote real. Like if some rando middle reliever, like, I don't know, Pedro Baez ripped off the best 25 innings of his life and had a 0 ERA and won the Cy, you'd probably look at that and go, that's kind of weird. But if DeGrom does it again, I don't know how you can look at that as anything but real. Like this guy has clearly moved ahead of Gerrit Cole for being the best pitcher in the game. Does that sound right?
Yeah, I think so. The consistency he's had over the last 3 years and the fact that Cole's been sort of like just okay with the Yankees, I think right now it's DeGrom.
Well, so if he does win, then he will be one of the very few pitchers in baseball history to win three Cy Youngs. And if you do that, you are more or less guaranteed entry into the Hall of Fame. There are 10 guys who have done it, and seven of them are in the Hall of Fame. Randy Johnson, Steve Carlton, Greg Maddux, Sandy Koufax, Pedro Martinez, Jim Palmer, and Tom Seaver. There are two more who are still active. That's Kershaw and Scherzer, who I think are both all but guaranteed to get into the Hall of Fame. And the final one is Roger Clemens, who certainly merits it, but obviously is not likely to get in for a variety of reasons. So here's my question. Jacob DeGrom has not had a long career. he did not make his first opening day roster until he was 27 years old. He's already 32, despite the fact he's only been around for a couple years. And yet a third Cy Young, is that amount of sheer greatness in such a short time? And obviously you expect he'll continue to be good for a few years. Can that overcome what is going to be, you know, you're certainly not going to have the bulk that a lot of these guys who came up when they were 21. Like, it's maybe too soon to start talking about his Hall of Fame candidacy, but if he gets that third Cy, that's rarefied air, right? Like, you got to at least start thinking about it.
Yeah, I mean, probably be the most jarring thing for his candidacy is, and you'll laugh at me, but it's like the number of wins that he has, because I think right now he has 69.
69 and 50. That's his career. 69 and 50. He's 3-1 this year.
So like, if like, you know, even in if he suddenly starts like actually getting a lot of decisions and racking up just, you know, 10, you know, 12 to 15 wins for the next few years, he's almost certainly not even going to get to 150, right? Which would be like way low for even like a starting pitcher in the Hall of Fame. I guess, you know, the comp, I think the comp would be Johan Santana, right? Johan Santana was like the best pitcher in baseball for a brief period. He only won two Cy Youngs. He finished third in one year in between, although he probably should have won that one. That was the one that like Bartolo Colon won. Santana should have three straight, but he won 139 games, 52 career WAR per Baseball Reference. So that's like probably like the comp we'd be looking at for DeGrom. And Santana didn't even, did Santana fall off the ballot his first year?
I think so.
And he didn't even sniff the Hall of Fame. So obviously he didn't get the third Cy Young either. So, right. So that could actually kind of, you know, yeah, he had, the thing working against Santana though, was the ballot was when he, it was actually 2 years ago. He was on the ballot. He only got 2.4% of votes. Working against him is like the ballots have been packed the last few years. You know, theoretically there probably will be some kind of like, clearing of the ballot, and that's already been going on, so that when DeGrom gets there, it will be easier. There'll be an easier path for him to get there. I think he is better positioned than Santana for a lot of reasons. If he gets to the third Cy Young, that's one. Two, the electorate's changing. Like by the time DeGrom is eligible, and this obviously assumes some level of dominance for what, like five more years? Maybe not like this, but you know, like, you know, number one, number two star, you know, if he fades into being like a number two starter over the next 5 years, right? You and I will, like, the voters are going to change. You and I will be voting by the time that DeGrom is eligible. And in the scenario we're discussing, like, I think I would, you know, very seriously consider him. And I think there are a lot more probably like-minded voters joining the ranks who would consider them for those reasons. You?
Well, yeah, if and when we are fortunate enough to get the vote, which for me is, I think five more years and you're what, like seven?
Yeah.
Something like
I think DeGrom will probably, and my guess is assuming, you know, barring something unforeseen, by the time I'm voting, we'll both be voting by the time he's eligible.
Right. So he's 32 right now. He has started 179 games. He has about 1,150 innings and 35 wins above replacement. So I actually looked into all current Hall of Famers and I tried to find, like, what are the lowest minimums for those things? I actually found it harder than I thought, because there were some guys who are like, oh yeah, I think of Sandy Koufax as a starter, right? He actually pitched in relief like a lot early in his career. So it's sort of hard to draw the line of who's a starter and who's not a starter. And I sort of did it in pencil. But so he's got 179 games started. The fewest games started by a starting pitcher in the Hall of Fame is 230 by Dizzy Dean. If he's healthy, he's going to get to 230. And if he's not healthy, then we're not even having this conversation. The fewest innings pitched by a Hall of Famer overall, he's already passed it. It's 1,042. By Bruce Sutter, but obviously he's not a reliever. The fewest innings pitched by a starting pitcher in the Hall of Fame. Again, it's what's a starting pitcher? It's either Dizzy Dean with 1,967 or Sandy Koufax with just over 2,300. I think he'll get past Dean and closest to Koufax. And then the lowest wins above replacement by a starting pitcher in the Hall of Fame. I'm kind of discounting some ancient guys from the 19th century here, but 36.3 by Catfish Hunter. DeGrom's already at 35, so he'll beat that by the end of this season. So if we're just looking at, like, is he better than some of the lesser guys in the Hall of Fame? I think we're going to have the answer to that by, like, next summer. And you're right. If he has two more fantastic seasons and then three or four good seasons after that, this seems like a pretty easy conversation to me. And if he doesn't, then we don't have to talk about it, because then he's not even close.
Well, the standard for what makes a Hall of Fame starting pitcher is going to have to keep changing, right? Otherwise no starters are going to, because no one's getting 200 wins, let alone 300 wins, right? So like, even that's going to kind of There probably will be a pitcher between now and DeGrom. I'm not sure if one comes to mind off the top of my head. But he might end up being like the kind of like the big test case of like, okay, what does it take? You know, let's kind of like rip up what we think a Hall of Fame starting pitcher looks like. Let's forget about, you know, the workhorses of the 70s and 80s, which I think kind of just kind of, 60, the workhorses of like the 60s and the 70s and early 80s just sort of like, I think, warped people's perception of like what, you know, like what Tom Seaver and like Steve Carlton were doing is just like, it's not possible anymore. So like we have to like, you know, obviously we've been talking a lot about Tom Seaver in light of his unfortunate passing last week and just like some of the numbers he put up. It's just like, I mean, he had, you know, I looked at, this was like my favorite Seaver stat. He's the only pitcher ever who had a 5-war season at age 22 or younger and a 5-war season at age 40 or older. I mean, how is that?
I know that one.
For longevity and dominance. Like
that was
so like there's no one's gonna do that. And DeGrom's extreme in his own right. I mean, he didn't debut till he was, you know, as you said, till he was 26. But even a guy like Garrett Cole, who was the first pick in the draft and basically was like in the majors the next year and like a good pitcher who became a great one, like they're not getting to these benchmarks. So we kind of have to forget about them and rethink what a Hall of Fame pitcher is, because we're not gonna just stop putting starting pitchers in the Hall of Fame, right?
We basically have.
Well, I think at some point the swing in voters is going to change that. And
that's true.
We'll start seeing, you know, even Kershaw, who is like, you know, in the conversation for best pitcher ever, right? What's his current win total? I'm pulling it up now as we speak.
Well, he's not going to get to like, you know, 300 or anything. Nobody's going to get to
300. That's sort of what I'm saying, right? Like,
yeah.
There's a argument for Kershaw, who's basically the same age as DeGrom, but obviously he peaked, you know, as effective as Kershaw still currently is, and he's still very good. He's been very good this year. He just hasn't had any durability for the last few years. He seemingly peaked like, you know, in 2015, but he's at 174 wins, right? And he'll probably get to 220, you know,
sure. Like,
which is a big number. That's basically, that's sort of like, that's essentially like going to be like the new high mark, right? The Kershaw, a guy who debuted at 20, was a star at 23 and dominant for a decade plus, is going to end up with like low 200s. And that's sort of how we think of like what like a high level win total can be.
Yeah, anyone who knows me knows that I have no regard for pitcher wins and losses, and I think that's actually been exacerbated this year when I see some of the relievers who start a game at extra innings and there's a runner on second, and if that run scores, it's an unearned run, right? Like it's not counted as an earned run, but that guy still gets the loss, which is hilarious, and I don't know why we bother doing that. 2 weeks ago I went on vacation for a couple of days and you filled in for me with Will Leach, which was a very good show, and you tweeted about it. And I saw someone reply to your tweet, paraphrasing because I don't have it in front of me. Why don't you ever talk about the A's? And I don't know if you were talking poorly about the A's or not talking about the A's at all. I feel like I talk about the A's a lot. Like I generally talk about the three teams I think I talk about the most are the A's, the Rays, and the Rockies, which I know are a weird combination. But because I always appreciate listener feedback, Matt is going to talk about the A's. And specifically, you want to focus on the bullpen.
Well, because yeah, I was starting to dig into the A's, and I was like, well, what makes the A's, you know, special, right? And I think that like going into the season, my thought was like, oh well, you know, Matt Chapman, he was actually my MVP pick in the American League.
Womp womp.
I mean, he's got 10 homers, but he also has a 276 OBP. The defense is still excellent, but you know, 276 OBP, the whole MVP thing, that's not happening. You know, and then you've got Matt Olson, who's hitting home runs, but also hitting 188. So like there, and Marcus Semien has a 277 OBP. So if you heard those things when this going into the season, you would have been like, wow, if Chapman and Matt Olson and Semien all kind of hit on the low end of their expectations, the A's aren't going to be very good at all.
Can I interrupt you for 1 second? I'm looking at this now. Who's the best hitter on the A's this year?
Robbie Grossman.
Can't say I saw that one coming. I'm sorry. Go on.
No, Robbie Grossman is like one of the, I feel like he just like, my vision of Robbie Grossman is the guy who just sort of like gets like passed around AL teams and just sort of like appears in new teams.
Like, it's like off-brand Corey Dickerson.
But he's always been a pretty good OBP guy, and he's definitely been a very good OBP guy this year, 394, but also slugging over 500 and having a really nice year. So anyway, if you'd come into this year and said, okay, if the A's are going to succeed, it's going to be because Chapman, Semien, and Olson really carry them, right? Well, no. Those guys have all been actually pretty bad, and yet the A's are, they're now like six games ahead of the Astros in the loss column, 4.5 in the standings. And I was like, so what, how are the A's doing this? Well, as it turns out, their bullpen has just been, and I knew it was good, but it was like, as I dug into it, I was like, oh, wow, it's been really good. They have by far the lowest bullpen ERA in baseball. They're at 2.09, which is almost a half run better than number two, the Dodgers, who are 2.55. I also found, comically, the Phillies are 30th at 7.24. Yes, that's right. The Phillies bullpen is a full, bullpen ERA is a full five runs higher than the A's. The Phillies obviously made some trades to try and address that at the deadline. They've been playing very well, so I don't think that's a true reflection of the Phillies bullpen. It's just comical to look at. But the A's bullpen is just like filled with really interesting guys. You know, we talked, I think a few weeks ago, you and I had this conversation of like, who's the best reliever in baseball? And at the time I sort of was like, well, I think that like, objectively speaking, it kind of comes down to, when you consider like current performance and like 2-year track record, it probably comes down to Nick Anderson versus Liam Hendricks, as silly as that sound. And since we had that conversation, Nick Anderson got hurt and Liam Hendricks continues to just like be a dominant reliever. He's got a 1.47 ERA. His expected ERA based on Statcast, like batted ball, quality of contact and strikeouts and walks, is 2.32, which is basically the same as last year when he was arguably the best reliever in baseball. So this is no fluke. He's got a 40% strikeout rate, a 4.4% walk rate, so he strikes out everyone and walks no one. His slider, which is not actually his primary pitch, it's like his number two pitch, he throws a ton of four seamers and a slider. The expected weighted on base against his slider this year is 0.017. It's basically impossible to make good contact on his slider, is basically what it's saying. So they've got Liam Hendricks, a strong argument now as the best reliever in baseball. And then the other guy who really stands out to me as interesting is Jake Diekman, who I feel like he had a moment like 3 years ago, I think maybe when he was with the Rangers, where he had like a stretch in a couple months where he was like the flavor of the month, like, great new reliever. I feel like if we were doing like our Let's Discover a Guy in 2017, Jake Diekman would have come up. But he's had some struggles. But this year, he's thrown 15 innings, has not allowed a single run. And that's not a fluke. His 2.52 expected ERA is in the top 5% of the league. So he's really been one of the most dominant pitchers. And what's fascinating about him, the walks are still a little bit high, still walking 16% of batters. So that's the kind of thing that in a tight playoff game might give you a little bit of pause. But the thing about him is that he changed his slider during the year this year, and he did it from the Pitching Ninja on Twitter. David Adler wrote a great piece about this on MLB.com that basically when the season began, Diekman had was throwing more of like a traditional slider with 7 inches of horizontal break. And then he saw the Pitching Ninja tweet Chaz Rose slider. And you've probably heard us talk about Chaz Rose slider on this podcast. He's on the Rays. I don't even know how to describe Chaz Rose slider. It's like, calling it a Frisbee slider doesn't even do it justice. It's a wiffle ball. It's like a cheat pitch, right? How would you describe it?
Frisbee from hell. I mean, it moves like a foot horizontally.
So Diekman tweeted at the Pitching Ninja. He was like, hey, can you show me that Chaz Rowe grip? And the Pitching Ninja has like a Dropbox folder with like pitch photos of pitch grips. And he tweeted it back at Jake Diekman. And Jake Diekman has basically changed his slider during the season. It is now getting it was like 7 inches of horizontal break. Now he's getting like 15 inches of horizontal break, and has he's basically trying to emulate this like crazy Chaz Rowe slider. It's not exactly the same type of movement, but it just speaks to the weapons that pitchers now have at their disposal, not just the modern technology in their own clubhouses, but also people on Twitter at their disposal who tweet GIFs and allow them to change their repertoire on the fly. And so you've got Hendricks, you've got Diekman, and they also have a bunch of other JB Wendelken is really good. Yusmer Partee is reliably solid. They have this huge, the big X factor is also Birch Smith, who they got from the Giants in the offseason, who was basically a nobody, who's increased his spin rate. And maybe that's related to him hurting his arm. He's been excellent this year. He might be back for the playoffs. It's a little unclear, but I look at the A's, they're starting pitchers. There was a lot of talk, oh, this year, this is your Frankie Montas, Sean Manea, Jesus Luzardo. It's going to be a great young rotation. Those guys have been okay. Some of them, their underlying metrics suggest that maybe they're better than their ERAs, but it's really been the bullpen that's kind of carrying the team, while the starting pitchers, the supposed stars of the team, the starting pitchers and their trio of infielders has really struggled.
Yeah, who's the best starting pitcher for Oakland this year? Is it actually Chris Bassitt? Which is kind of surprising because, you know, Fiers has been fine. Montas, as you said, you know, I kind of expected big things because he was so good last year before he got suspended and he hasn't been that great. I'm out on Sean Manaea just because the velocity is never there. And when you look at the bullpen, as you said, Hendricks, obviously, but there's just like sort of a random collection of guys because you have these two veterans in Joaquin Soria, who's been around forever, and Yusmeiro Petit, who's really been around forever. He's been around so long, he was once traded for Carlos Delgado. He's been around so long. I looked this up. You want to remember some guys? Because we're about to. His major league debut came in a Florida-Pittsburgh game in May of 2006. Do you know who the left side of the infield was for the Marlins that day? Hanley Ramirez at shortstop and Miguel Cabrera at third base. Those are some guys. This was a particularly dark time in Pittsburgh history. Jeremy Burnitz was in right and Jason Bay was in left, and Jose Bautista was the leadoff man at third base, and Yusmeiro Petit got into that game. I kind of hadn't noticed until we started talking about this how good JB Wendelken has been. He's sort of like, you know, just a guy, but I remember last year every time I would look up like the expected statistics from Statcast, like who's striking out guys well and preventing walks and preventing loud contact, and he always popped near the top. And they just never seemed to prioritize him. So I thought maybe it was a small sample size thing. So it's kind of cool to see how great he's been. And it's also, you know, they had a really good bullpen, what, 2 years ago too, but it was largely based around Hendricks, who's still good, Blake Treinen, who's now with the Dodgers, and Lou Trevino, who's, you know, still there, but he has not been necessarily, you know, one of the primary guys. So they've done a fantastic job of turning things around. And they also traded for Mike Minor from Texas, who has not actually been that good in his first start or two for the A's, and I don't know if he'll actually start in the postseason, but yeah, it's fun. Like, they've been very good for the last 2 years and they're very good this year, just in an entirely different way than you could have ever have expected. It'd be nice if, like, you know, Olsen started crushing the ball again, and, you know, Piscotty's like been fine. Chris with a K, Davis seems totally cooked. Like, this is the second year of this now. Anyway, I like the A's because they are always zigging, I guess. I don't know, but I'm in on them, and I hope that they get to, you know what I want? I want A's, Rays, ALCS. That I would watch.
Well, I mean, you look at the thing is, you look at the bullpen, and that's part of the reason I've hoped for them is like, it's because it's like, it's a bullpen, but it's also, it's deep. Like they you know, like in a, you know, because especially this postseason with so many games, you know, you're going to have the first round of three best of three, and then the best of five and seven and seven, like they're not going to have to rely on just like two relievers or three relievers. Like, you know, they can go, you know, like six or seven deep and like really cycle through very good relievers in every game, even if they need to get a lot of innings, because I don't expect their starting pitchers to go deep in games. So that sort of like, I think, puts them in a good position where they're not going to be in a situation where they have to use the same guys over and over again. Obviously they're going to want to use Hendricks in as many games as they can, but he can't pitch in every game. So they still have Soria and Diekman and Wendelken. So it's like, is it Wendelken or Wendelken?
I believe it's the first, but I guess I'm not 100% sure.
Anyway, but like, and even Trevino, who's still been like, you know, good this year. So it's not like, it's a very deep bullpen. And I think that I would love to see a Rays A's ALCS as well. I feel like we've sort of actually sort of like stolen our next segment by like, hey, that's like, talking about the A's bullpen is a very good segue into being like, let's now discover some more guys you probably don't know a lot about.
Well, I made sure that my guy this week was not a nameless reliever. I have a nameless catcher. I want to talk about Pedro Severino of the Orioles, a team I guess we're going to have to focus on more soon. I want to know if Pedro Severino is just a guy or if he's a capital letter, a guy. He signed with the Nationals a decade ago in 2010 as an amateur free agent, spent parts of 2015 through 18 with them, you know, 282 plate appearances, a 48 OPS plus. Seems like your typical third catcher, right? And he actually got DFA'd before last season because he wasn't going to make the team and he was out of options. He was claimed a couple days later by the Orioles and he was fine. You know, he actually hit okay, you know, 96 games, a 95 OPS plus. I was doing research for him on this and I actually found a tweet of my own from December 19th of last year where I said, I'm working up an end of the year piece and somehow Pedro Severino had one of the most incredible years we didn't even notice. And then I said in parentheses, He's a catcher for Baltimore. It's okay if you didn't know that. So that should tell you how notable he was. That's because last year I was writing about the, you know, the most extreme moments of 2019, like kind of holiday coverage pieces you do at the end of the year. And he popped up for two reasons. One is he was one of the few guys who got a hit on a batted ball that had a 1% hit probability, which basically means he popped it up and the fielders stood around and looked at each other as it fell for a hit. He also had the fastest pop time to second base on any individual throw of anybody last year, 1.75 seconds. And then also, he somehow hit three homers in a game in Texas and also almost blew the game, a 12-11 win, because he almost had a passed ball on the final pitch. So anyway, that put him on my radar. I found him to be a fascinating guy. Here's what I didn't expect. This year, he's hitting 325, 403 on base, a 518 slugging percentage. He is 50% better than the league average. His underlying expected statistics are similar to Kyle Seager, Robinson Cano, JD Davis, and Mike Yastrzemski. And yet, he doesn't hit the ball hard. He is in the 21st percentile in hard hit rate. Now he's doing other things well. He's striking out less. He's walking more. When he puts the ball in the air, he's pulling it a little more. He's like, you know, doing these little things. But that line is not a fluke. His actual weighted on base is 390 and his expected is 388. He's still only 27 years old. He is one of many reasons that this Baltimore team that everybody expected to be like literally the worst team in big league history. Like you thought it was going to be, you know, 62 Mets, 2003 Tigers, 2020 Orioles. Like that's how we thought about this team. And they are, you know, close to 500. Pedro Severino is a big part of that out of nowhere. So credit to him.
What'll be interesting is how they sort of position Severino, because they're like kind of their franchise prospect, right, as a catcher, Adley Rutschman. And good catching is really hard to come by in this day and age. So like theoretically, I'm not saying they're going to trade Severino this offseason, but like, you know, Rutschman is probably someone, it's hard to know how, like it's, this year is kind of hard to tell from a development standpoint under like a normal timeline. Rutschman is like a number one overall pick as a catcher, probably would have, you know, he was the number one pick in 2018. He probably would have been like sort of ready for 2021. Number one pick number 19 in 2019. So he'd probably be ready for 2021. So it'll be interesting to see how they position Severino with Rutschman on the way. They're obviously not in a rush to move him because he is he's under club control. He hits arbitration for the first time this offseason. So he's got three more years of club control, but that also could make him really valuable as a trade chip. And I don't know if he will ever be more valuable than he's going to be this offseason. So, but either way,
you know what that is? What? That's a good problem to have.
Exactly. That is a good problem to have indeed. The Orioles are sort of, they're similar to the Giants, the team I'm about to talk about, with like they're kind of surprised people with a bunch of kind of like breakouts by like not mid-career players, but guys in their like sort of like mid to late 20s that are kind of coming on in ways that you wouldn't have, you know, expected in, you know, with the Orioles, guys like Anthony Santander and Pedro Severino. And then you have a team like the Giants where like Mike Yastrzemski has taken a huge step forward. And then you had a guy like Austin Slater. Austin Slater is a guy who his name popped up over the weekend because he hit a leadoff home run in against Madison Bumgarner and Madison Bumgarner's first game pitching back in against the Giants. And Austin Slater coming into this year in 544 career plate appearances had 1.1 career total WAR per Fangraphs. This year in 68 plate appearances, he has 1.1 WAR per Fangraphs. So in 68 plate appearances, he has equaled what he had done in 544 plate appearances. And he's interesting. When you go on like the leaderboard for like barrels, which I always like to do, barrels, which is like the Statcast metric for like the optimal way you could hit a baseball in terms of exit velocity and launch angle for the likelihood of getting a extra base hit. He's in terms of barrels per plate appearances, he's among the leaders. Granted, he has not been an everyday player. He's been hurt a little bit, that's kind of, so he does not qualify, but among players of the 388 players with 25 balls in play, his 10.3% barrels per plate appearance is 21st. So that's obviously a small sample size, but it's real, as real as can be, I guess. And the thing you notice about him when you start to dig a little deeper is that he is someone who's, you know, tried not to get all like 2017 on you, but he's like seemed to have joined the launch angle revolution, so to speak. Last year, His average launch angle was 3.4 degrees. This year, 13.9 degrees. So he's getting the ball in the air, and he's hitting 328, 426, 603. They spot him a little bit. I mean, I think they saw him as kind of a platoon player. His overall line against righties is pretty good. He's got like an 800 OPS, but he's also has a 421 batting average on balls of play against righties, so it feels a little fluky. Against lefties, however, he's hitting 400, 516, 800. So he clearly is a bit of a lefty masher. One thing I found interesting about him as well is that he went to college at Stanford. He was a eighth round pick in 2014. And for those who follow like the draft and amateur baseball, there's sort of this like thing about Stanford hitters. It's called the Stanford swing. And it's become sort of like, it was over the years, it's become like a pejorative, like a negative thing you say about Stanford hitters. And what's happened, I mean, it mostly happened to their longtime coach, Mark Marquess, and he's not there anymore, but the idea, Slater was there when Marquess was still there. The idea is that for a long time, so it goes, I'm not, you know, this is just sort of the reputation. I'm not speaking to the necessarily the accuracy of it. The reputation was that like Stanford players were taught sort of to hit for contact, to hit the other way, that they were not taught to drive the ball. And that was sort of like the knock on Stanford prospects. And for a long time, there was a lot of Stanford hitting prospects who came out of college with a ton of hype, who just like, you know, never panned out. There were a lot of guys who were really, we can remember some guys who came with a lot of hype who did not pan out at all. Jeffrey Hammonds, who was like a top five draft pick. John Mayberry Jr., who was a first round draft pick.
Carlos Quentin was one of those guys.
Quentin was one of the success stories, right? I think he actually hit like 35 home runs. He was like sort of
How about Joe Borchard?
Joe Borchard, there you go. So anyway, but Slater is, you know, whatever you think about the Stanford swing, he's clearly tried to change his approach. Last year in an interview with the McCovey Chronicles, he was quoted as saying, "The launch angle and loft, they're the big buzzwords now, but hitters have been doing that forever. I think cleaning up bat path is another way to put it. Hitters have always done it, but creating the launch angle and loft is a direct effect of cleaning up your bat path and how you enter the zone." In the same article, he talked a little bit how he was kind of taught to sort of chop wood, and that he was sort of just instead of trying to like chop down on the ball, just trying to keep a smooth swing through the strike zone. And again, we're talking about a small sample here, but if you're looking about players who sort of open your eyes a little bit in terms of the quality of contact that they're making, Austin Slater jumps to the top of the list. And when you look at reasons for why the Giants are surprising, I think he's a huge reason why.
He is. And yet you did not mention the most interesting fact about Austin Slater, which is that as a senior in high school, he broke his ankle before the season playing ultimate frisbee, which I find to be a very interesting life story. It kind of tanked his draft stock, and he ended up getting drafted in the 44th round by the Dodgers and chose not to sign and instead go to Stanford. And I guess that has worked out for him. All right, we're going to finish off with our purpose pitch, our closing rant. And I'm glad, Matt, that you just mentioned barrels, because this one's going to be so much about barrels. I feel like we need to have stronger opinions on who gets to be nicknamed barrels. Let's stick with the Giants. Donovan Solano is having a really good year for the Giants. There's no question about that. He's got a 353 average. His OPS is over 930. He's having a great year after kind of bouncing around. I remember him. He's like a nondescript guy with the Marlins for a bunch of years. I don't remember the 9 games he played for the Yankees in 2016, but I guess he did. So great. Good for him. He's having a good year, and he has been nicknamed Donnie Barrels. So as Matt explained, a barrel is a StatCast term for perfect combination of exit velocity and launch angle. To go a little deeper, it means you have to have on a given batted ball an expected average of at least 500. So it's got to be a hit half the time, and an expected slugging of 1500. So it's got to be a powerful hit. Right? Barrels are, you know, the guys who crush baseballs hit barrels. Donovan Solano has a 353 average. That's true. He's also got just 7 barrels this year. The leaders have over 20, and he's in the 29th percentile of barrels. I reject this name for Donovan Solano, and this isn't the first time. Back in 2018, Blue Jays backup catcher Luke Maley, who has a 304 career slugging percentage, got the nickname Lukey Barrels because he had a couple of big walk-off hits. Stroman tweeted about it, and he went so far as to wear Lukey Barrels on his jersey for Players Weekend. The year before, in 2017, Pat Valaika, who had a couple of big hits for the Rockies that year, was nicknamed by Bud Black Patty Barrels. He has a career slugging percentage of 412. And I say, no, I say, none of these guys deserve the distinguished nickname of barrels. And then I thought to myself, well, who should it be? Should it be the man with the single season barrels record, which I forgot to look up, but I'm pretty sure is Aaron Judge from a couple years ago. Aaron Barrels doesn't really roll off the tongue. And I don't know, Aaron Barrels feels like he manages a Fuddruckers in Ohio or something, and Judge is hurt all the time anyway. Should it be who has the most barrels of the season? Right now, that's Fernando Tatis Jr. Fernando Barrels doesn't sound great either, and I actually feel like that undersells all of the great things that Tatis can do. Should it be the most barrels since we began tracking this in 2015? Now, here it gets interesting. Only three hitters have had at least 300 barrels in that time. Number three is JD Martinez. Okay, that's a good one. Number two is Mike Trout. He's not going to be Mikey Barrels because he's so good at literally everything else. The most barrels since 2015, 329 by Nelson Cruz. Nelly Barrels? That sounds good. And that's what he does. Doesn't play defense. He crushes. I like Nelly Barrels.
I like JD. I think JD Barrels. The judges would also accept JD Barrels.
JD Barrels is good too, but he's actually not having that great of a year.
Nelson Cruz is just a, it's his career is just sort of mind blowing.
He's better this year.
He is three times. Granted, this is partially due to all the doubleheaders this year, but he has three times this year. He has homered in both games of a doubleheader. How awesome is Nelson Cruz? He's the best.
I also thought about potentially going with the complete troll face way to look at this, the ironic barrels for Rockies catcher Tony Walters, who has not had a barrel since August 27th of 2018. It was a home run and just barely, like the lowest possible qualification you can have for a barrel is a minimum of 98 miles an hour and a launch angle between 26 and 30. And the harder you hit it, the wider the launch angle gets. 98 between 26 and 30. That home run, 98.3 and 29. He has had 534 plate appearances since his last barrel. In the time since he hit his last barrel, Mike Trout has 98 of them. So Tony Barrels, I thought would be fun, but he probably doesn't want that. Therefore, I decree Nelly Barrels.
Bangs gavel. All right. For my purpose pitch, I want to talk about the Mookie Betts trade. The Mookie Betts trade was obviously one of the more controversial, I guess, you know, discussed, I don't know if controversial is the right word, moves of the offseason. Mookie Betts was a year from free agency, and the Red Sox traded him to the Dodgers with 1 year left before he hit free agency. In return, they got outfielder Alex Verdugo and two infield prospects, Jeter Downs and Connor Wong. And the Red Sox took a lot of heat for the move. You know, the belief, I think understandably, and this is not to defend their sort of willingness to just sort of like not even seemingly it, to the outsider, it seemed like they didn't really even try to re-sign Mookie Betts. It's hard to know exactly what happened, but it sort of seemed to seem like they saw Betts leaving as a free agent as sort of a foregone conclusion, and they were just going to trade him. They weren't prepared to spend the money, and a lot of people are like, well, you're the Red Sox, you know you're a big market team, you sell out all the time. If anyone should be re-signing a franchise player, it should be the Red Sox. And as the season's gone on, and I've seen, you know, as Betts is playing great for the Dodgers and is, you know, an MVP candidate, and the Red Sox are just having a terrible season, I've seen a lot of like, I can't believe the Red Sox just let Mookie Betts go takes. And I just, like, I think it's a little disingenuous. They didn't just let him go. Whether or not you want to defend ownership for trading him and whether they got enough for him, they didn't just let him go. They made a trade. They traded him with 1 year before free agency, which in baseball history is like a pretty common thing that happens more often with small market teams, but it does happen with big market teams. I mean, the Dodgers traded Mike Piazza in his year before free agency. Mike Piazza, the guy who was friends with like Tommy, whose dad was
Tommy Lasorda was his godfather.
Tommy Lasorda's godson, Mike Piazza. They traded Mike Piazza a few months before free agency. The Mariners traded Ken Griffey Jr. a year before free agency. This happens all the time. They did not just let Betts go. They added talent, and they also cleared some sort of fairly dead money on their payroll by moving David Price in the deal as well. If they felt like it was a long shot they were going to re-sign Mookie, it's not like a crazy thing to do. Like, it's, you know, we also don't know how they want to run their team. They may say like, we want to run, you know, like it's just kind of unknowable. And also, let's not forget Alex Verdugo, who they got in the trade, has been really good this year. He's hitting 311, 370, 523. He leads the AL in doubles. He has a 136 weighted runs created plus, where 100 is league average. So that's like a really good young piece who's, I think, his second year. So they'll have him under club control for like 4 or 5 more years. They also added Jeter Downs, who hasn't played this year because there has been no minor league baseball, but absolutely raked last year, who MLB Pipeline ranks is their number one prospect. So like we can like debate the merits of the trade, where they should have done it or not. Like, you know, I like it when teams can keep their core guys and you have that identity of player staying with one franchise for a long time. But like, it's not like they just let him walk and they didn't get anything for him. In fact, they got a lot more for him than if he had just left as a free agent. And it's pretty clear the Red Sox weren't going anywhere this year anyway, with or without Mookie Betts. So it may end up in the long run being not such a crazy trade, not such a bad trade for them, even from a baseball perspective.
Okay, let me agree with the things I agree with before I get to the rest of it. I do agree with you completely that acting as though they got nothing for him is disrespectful to how good Alex Verdugo is and how good Jeter Downs and Connor Wong, who was the catching prospect they got back, might be. You're totally right. They didn't get nothing. They got quality young players. I don't know if I agree about Price being dead money, because the Red Sox pitching staff is unwatchable. I mean, we couldn't have known at the time he was going to opt out, right? And maybe that, I don't know if that would have happened or not with Boston. It's just a tough look. Like, Betts is likely going to be a Hall of Famer. It seems to me there's no dollar amount that's too much for him. And you mentioned that the Dodgers did it with Mike Piazza. Well, that hits me in the sweet spot a little bit. I grew up a Dodger fan, and Mike Piazza is my favorite all-time player. Like, you have so few moments in your life where you're like, oh, I remember exactly where I was when that happened. For me, that was when Mike Piazza got traded. I was, let's see, how old would I have been? 14, I guess. I was working a summer job at the Boardwalk in the Jersey Shore, and I don't even remember how I found out Mike Piazza got traded. But it was crushing to me, and it was for the wrong reasons. It was because the O'Malley's had finally sold to like the Fox conglomerate, and as I remember, it wasn't even the GM who made the trade. It was like some rando Fox executive who everybody hated. And to be fair, they got, you know, Gary Sheffield, who had a good couple years for the Dodgers. But like, looking back, do I wish Mike Piazza went to the Hall of Fame as a Dodger and not a Met? I mean, listen, you grew up a Mets fan. I'm sure you love that Mike Piazza was a Met, but that doesn't happen probably without that trade. And I get what you're saying about the good players that got back. Verdugo's going to be fun to watch. But I don't know. If I'm a Red Sox fan, I still wish I had Mookie Betts around for the next 10 years.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And I think it's more just like, I think I sort of take issue with, like, I agree with you. And I even said that, like, I always like when teams can sort of keep their guys, right? Like, I think it's always just, it's better. It's just like, it's great when players have identity with franchises. You know, when you see, especially, you know, when players end their careers, you see that connection. It's always like, there's something really, really special about that. You know, I was there the night that, like, David Wright came back for like one last game with the Mets after not having played for like 2 years. And it was like this really cool, you know, special evening. It's like sort of like what fandom is all about, like fans together having that connection with the players. So like, I guess, you know, from that aspect, I'm with you. And if I was a Red Sox fan, I would be frustrated, because I would obviously prefer to have Mookie Betts. I think it's just like, I feel like it's what's gotten kind of lost is just, and maybe this is like a little bit cynical of me, is like, they actually did get some really good talent back. And just the fact that like this kind of thing is actually, like it or not, it's pretty common. This wasn't like they sort of like, you know, went way against any sort of like, you know, team building precedent by being like, well, this guy's a free agent next year. We're probably not going to re-sign him. So like, let's get what we can for him now. Like, that's just a thing that's done all the time. And I feel like it's kind of getting lost a little bit that that's kind of a common practice. And they actually got some pretty good players back.
Sure. They should have tried harder to re-sign him, but I agree with you that even if he was on the team in 2020, they still would have been very bad, because Mookie Betts is not a pitcher. That's our show for this week. That is the Ballpark Dimensions Podcast. I'm Mike. He is Matt. Thanks for listening.